This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Thanks for downloading the Intelligent Squared podcast. Here in London, we're already looking forward to the launch of our autumn season. One of the events we're really excited about is going to be on explaining how the technology that surrounds us actually works. And to do that, we're bringing together two of the world's masters of explaining and popularizing science. Randall Munro, the creator of the incredibly popular webcomic XKCD, and Marcus de Sautoy, Oxford's Professor for the Public Understanding of Science. That's happening on October the 2nd, and you can buy tickets for that at our website, intelligentsquared.com. Now, here's this week's episode. We hope you enjoy listening.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Kamal Ahmed, the economics editor of the BBC. Welcome, Satya, to London. Flew in today. I'm going to let you into a little secret. As the economics editor of the BBC and formerly business editor of the Sunday Telegraph, I get an awful lot of books written by chief executives. And 98% of them are abysmal. And they talk in management gobbledygook about how great they are and all the successes they've had, usually written at the end of their career, not slap bang in the middle. Luckily, Satya, yours is nothing like that. It came thumping through my letterbox at home, and I sort of looked at it in a slight degree of trepidation, thinking another one of these books that endlessly bores on about how great the person is. But actually, Satya's book is unusual, can I say, in that it not only speaks to the big issues of running global corporations, of being a technology leader in this era of such uncertainty about where the economy, where technology, where government is going with great honesty, but it also talks with great honesty about Microsoft itself, the mistakes, the things that need to change, and why they need to change. But also it touches on the huge issues that we're going to talk about tonight, as well as about Satya himself, as well as about Microsoft, the big issues around artificial intelligence, the growth of quantum computing, the notion of augmented reality, and what do they mean for us and the type of society we live in. So Satya, welcome. Kick off Hyderabad, where you were born, to only the third chief executive Microsoft has ever had. Just take us a little bit through that journey.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me here. You know, growing up in India, and as I reflected and wrote even in this book, I don't think I had this idea that one day I was going to make it to Redmond, Washington, and then become CEO of Microsoft. Although I'm definitely a product of American technology, in particular, even in fact, British and American technology, because my first computer my father bought for me was a Sinclair Z80. That's where I learned to program a bit in BASIC, and after that, the IBM PC with DOS and Microsoft BASIC had a huge influence. Although even when I was learning to code, let's say, I was more into cricket. I was born to two parents. My father was a civil servant with Marxist leanings, and my mother was a Sanskrit professor. And so they hardly could agree on anything, which meant that I could do whatever. And the only thing they agreed was I was wasting my time playing cricket, but I enjoyed it. And if you had asked me even as late as even perhaps my 12th grade, and said, what is your dream? I would have said, you know, play first class cricket for Hyderabad and, you know, work for a bank, and that would be wonderful. Mm-hmm. And somehow I think my father got the idea that that's very provincial, and he forced the hand and said, you got to go out, get out of this place.
Was it a place where you could succeed? Because now in India, there may be not as many push factors, given the great technological revolution that that country is and has experienced. Would there be the same push factors now as there were when you were young?
That's a great question. I mean, in some sense, I have, you know, ever since I was 21, I've been in the United States. But clearly what's happening, whether it's in India or even in other parts of the world, the idea that they can create digital technology in the country itself and the jobs associated with it, I think, are absolutely happening. I think the circumstances of what was possible when I was growing up versus what is now India's reality is two very different things. But to sort of finish up, I think the thing that at least I picked up in the school I went to and the milieu I grew up in was some strange combination of having intellectual ambition and the ability to take the moment, the opportunity you're given, and make the most of it. And those are the two things then, when I look back, perhaps shaped who I was, who I am, and what happened.
You talk in the book about a number of people who were colleagues who also came from India, this sort of Indian diaspora who went to the United States in particular and have been tremendously successful. What do you put that down to, that march of people into America and the success you had there?
I mean, I think, you know, I'm not deeply studied the diaspora, and especially into the United States, but there seemed to be, at least from what I can understand, two different phases. There was a phase early on when the American immigration policy allowed for skilled immigration, which led to, I think, a lot of doctors in particular showing up. And then I think I definitely was a beneficiary of the same immigration policy, but being applied to the growth in digital technology, especially in the early 90s, I think, is when a lot of us were able to come, participate, and contribute. And that's definitely, I mean, that's why I think I'm such a product of the United States. I always attribute it to these two amazingly unique things, America, and one is its technology reaching everywhere and allowing kids like me anywhere to dream the dream. And then the enlightened American immigration policy that even gave me the chance to live the dream. And so I think that that's a pretty unique American competitive advantage.
You joined Microsoft in 1992, raised through the business relatively rapidly, but you're sort of a dyed-in-the-wool Microsoft person. You write at the beginning of the book that when you took over at Microsoft 3.5 years ago, that this was a company where innovation had been replaced by bureaucracy, where teamwork had been replaced by internal politics. But you were the consummate insider. So what I was wondering as I was reading it, weren't you to blame slightly for those facts?
That's a great observation, because
might be rude, I don't know, but it's an observation.
I think it's absolutely right, because I grew up in Microsoft. I've spent 25 years of my life there. And everything that is good and everything that is wrong, I was part of it. And if anything, what I tried to do was not to go look back and say, let us change, but it was to rediscover. After all, here we are, 43 years after being founded, you know, competing with a whole set of new players, and it wouldn't have happened if we would have not gotten a lot of things right. But it's also important to acknowledge what didn't we get right. Amplify the things that really help us be at our best, And then get rid of the things that are obstacles. So that was the spirit with which at least I started. In fact, even Steve Ballmer's best advice was, hey, don't try to fill my shoes or don't be victim to my own dogma. Be your own person. And somehow, you know, as part of, even though I grew up at Microsoft, in all of the jobs I had, and I seeked out that outside-in perspective, as best as a consummate insider can, right? You know, you can't be completely objective about it. And there was enough of a debate even, you know, who should be CEO of Microsoft? Should an insider ever be picked, given what was at least being written about us? But in my case, I had a pretty first-class view of what it is that we who we are, what we should do, what should we make sure we get rid of as even cultural traits or what have you that were obstacles. And I think in retrospect, that is what was helpful. To your point, an insider and there who has some credibility, perhaps being critical of the past, knowing that I'm not criticizing myself, is what makes it even possible to change.
You talk in some detail, and you go back to, on a number of occasions, some of the, as you say, the mistakes that Microsoft made, or some of the things which became problematic. And I was particularly interested in Minecraft and Mojang, and also in Nokia. What is it about an organization where it seems difficult to seize the opportunity that with hindsight seems sort of blindingly obvious? And Minecraft, given that you did eventually buy it, you could have bought it a lot earlier, a lot cheaper than when you did actually do the deal. Why is it when a company can't see what an opportunity is and grab it?
You know, one of the things at least I observe, which I write about as the pattern at least, that I think all systems have, and in particular in business this is super important to recognize, is this amazing virtuous cycle that one gets into when one has the first success. After all, when you're a startup, you have nothing, but then you scale up, you have your hit. Around that concept or that hit, you build all the capability. And then around that capability, the culture also develops. So you have this amazing lock between your concept, your capability, and your culture. And they reinforce each other. And it keeps growing. Except there is no such thing as a perpetual motion machine. At some point, whatever you started growing or whatever was the hit stops being one. And now the time's come for you to come up with the next hit. In order to do that, you need new capability. Whatever capability you may have had in the past may not be enough. Sometimes line extensions are easy, but line extensions are not all growth. Culture will then fight that. So that is what I think we need to recognize.
And was that the PC? Was that where the lock came? Democratizing the PC was Bill Gates's great statement to the world. And did that become the lock for your business?
But if you look at it, one of the things that we were able to do at Microsoft, and it's in fact even true today about our business, is we are much more diversified. In some sense, you know, you can say we caught three or four big ones, and we missed a few big ones. So think about it. The PC, obviously, but you know, even let's even say Office was the first big hit. In fact, the Microsoft Office and most Word, Excel were all built for the Macintosh before even Windows was a success. Then we had Windows in Office. Then when I joined, for example, in 1992, no one thought we will ever have a server business. After all, what does a PC company have anything to do with servers? That was the conventional wisdom. And then we went after it, and we obviously became big in servers, and now we have a cloud business. In parallel, we even built a gaming business with Xbox. So we have done multiple things. But did we miss the web? Big one. Did we miss search?
Even I've heard of that.
You know, did we miss search?
Yeah.
Those are all big misses. And mobile is another one. So, but at that same time, I think that's the perspective one needs to have. As I always say, you know, you can aspire to be Don Bradman, but having an above 50 average is not a bad idea for a good test career. So I think that companies really do need to think about, hey, don't rue the misses. but be more cognizant of what really enabled Microsoft to have four major hits. How many businesses have these 10 billion plus franchises?
Okay, tell us, Satya, what are the keys to the big hits? We'll get back to the misses in a second, but let's hear about the hits first.
And it's that.
You talk about a growth mindset. It's part one of your things in your book.
It's a great point, which is, in some sense, one of the things that I said, well, what's the meme we can have where this culture that we have today doesn't inhibit us to go after a new concept or building of new capability? And that is where, my wife had actually introduced me to this book by Carol Dweck called Mindset, a few years before I'd become CEO. And I was reading it more in the context of my daughters. And that book talks about this very simple metaphor that it's better to be a learn-it-all versus a know-it-all. And I think large successful companies tend to culturally become know-it-alls because after all, you're successful, you must know something. Except if you don't have that learn-it-all posture, you're not going to be open. So that's where the concept of growth mindset comes from.
You speak a lot in the book about culture, and you talk about empathy. And this is a world where there's a lot of cynicism about business. You're talking about empathy not just internally, but particularly externally, and particularly with your customers in the main you talk about. But I was quite interested in that idea of empathy, an empathetic approach, given that lots of people are suspicious that businesses aren't empathetic at all. They're just about their investors and the bottom line and making as much profit as possible. Tell us a bit about this approach and why you use this word empathy so regularly.
To me, one of the things I look back and say, when did we create our best products and these hits? Beyond having a culture, which was, let's say, more the learn-it-all culture, I think the thing that we also had was a deep sense for what are the unmet, unarticulated needs of customers. Because if you said, okay, I'm going to talk to five people and sort of do what they tell me to do, that's definitely not going to really get you to a hit product. You have to have a deeper intuition. Where does that come from? I believe the best source of it is empathy. When you are observing the world, when you're talking to customers, when you're seeing things happen, if you are truly listening, not just to the words, but sort of what's behind them, that's the inspiration for innovation. And so it's an existential business need. Then the question is, how does one develop it? I can't go to work and say, oh, I'm going to be empathetic. Because that's just, it's impossible to just switch it on if you don't have essentially the learning from your own life's experience. That's one of the things I sort of even perhaps more so thought through in this book. Why do I talk like this? Or where did this come from, at least in my case? And then I realized that it all came from these hard lessons, whether it was that first interview question or the last interview question that I got in my Microsoft, after 8 hours of solving these math puzzles and computer science algorithms, the interviewer asked me, what will you do if you see a baby who's fallen on the street? And I thought, oh my God, this is an algorithm I didn't learn. There must be some puzzle here I've got to solve. And I searched for a couple of minutes, and then I said, I'll call 911. The interviewer just gets up, and he walks out and shows me, sends me on my way, and he says, when a baby falls, you pick them up and hug them. And I thought so much. I thought I blew it and I'll never get the job, but, eventually I did. But that's the kind of experience, or whether it's the birth of my son, which was another very big turning point for us. Those are the moments that, in some sense, grounded me. But having had those personal experiences, I think they informed who I was as a leader, a manager, as an engineer. And that's the connection, at least, I see.
I want to pick up on the engineer point in a minute, but I do want to ask you about, you talk very movingly about Zane, your wife, Anu, and Zane, your son, who has special needs, was born very prematurely. What did you take from that, which allowed you to, as you say, you can't switch empathy on, but what was it about that experience that changed maybe the way you viewed not just your personal life, but also your work life?
Yeah, I mean, for Anu and me, it was our first child. Both of us were only children of our parents. And if you even had asked me an hour before he was born, what was top of mind for me? It was all about, hey, is the nursery going to be ready? Is Anu going to get back to a job as an architect? What will our weekends be like? And all
bit
of that.
An engineer, maybe, still.
That's right. and I was then... obviously, everything changed. He was born with severe brain damage, which led to cerebral palsy. And then I watched Anu pick up, you know, in fact, right after she came out, she had a C-section. As soon as she could recover as quickly as possible, she was driving him to therapy after therapy, and everything that came so naturally to her as to what she needed to do to give Zane the best chance didn't come to me. I was more thinking about what happened to me, what happened to my plans, why did this happen? And I must say, it took me maybe even 2 years or more to truly internalize that nothing actually happened to me. Something happened to Zane, and I had to step up and see the world through his eyes and do my job as his father. And I now understand that. I don't think the process was that linear. It was tumultuous. But it definitely shaped who I am. It perhaps gave me a better sense of being able to see things through others' eyes, whether it's people who work with you as colleagues or people whom you're leading or even customers. And in a very subtle way, I think it defined, it was perhaps the hit refresh moment in my life.
Do you think that there is a broader issue? Clearly, you went through an incredible emotional journey. I've been fortunate enough to interview lots of heads of technology companies, those big global companies of which you now run one. Is the problem sometimes with trying to connect with the human world out there that it is run by engineers who maybe lack that journey that you've been through, which has maybe opened yourself up to a different approach, that you can sometimes have an issue that you are run by engineers who find it hard to connect with the concerns of the outside world? And we're going to start going on to those in a little while about AI and such like.
I mean, I hope not. But I do believe, to your core of your question, that in a world, we'll talk more, I'm sure, about this, in a world where there is, let's say, abundance of artificial intelligence, what's going to be scarce is real intelligence or human intelligence and human qualities like empathy that all of us need. It's not going to be like I can do a Fourier transform very fast is probably going to be a commodity. What may not be a commodity is the ability to relate to people. And whether you're an engineer, I think great innovation, quite frankly, as an engineer comes because of your real empathy you have for the problems you want to solve for people, after all. But I would subscribe to that point of view that let us, even in how we talk about the need for new skills, don't do it in such a way that it's so narrow that we lose, I think, what makes us unique as humans and our ability in particular to relate to each other.
What did you find was the biggest challenge starting at Microsoft as chief executive in a company that you had not been chief executive for such a long time? I just wondered what the main challenge was for you.
You know, one of the things which is very different, and I've not realized this, is, and in fact, Steve had sort of even referenced this, and Mrs. Balmer had referenced this, and I never really got it before he left. As a CEO, you can be a CEO of a small company or a large company. The one thing that the CEO does see is very unique because structurally you see everything left to right, what's happening in your organization. No one who works on your team sees it that way you see it because they all have, by definition, their job to do, which there's a structure around it. And the people you work for, in our case our board, also don't see it. So there is always this asymmetry. But in some sense, you've got to get your judgment right based on what you see.
So that's one, I would say, there's nothing that prepares you for it.
What did you learn from the fact, as you write about in the book, that Microsoft was left standing on the cloud by Amazon? What did you learn from that?
You know, it's one of those things I write quite a bit in the book about. It's a classic case, perhaps, of what even people will say is the challenge of that lock between your capability, concept, and culture. We had a very successful data center business. In fact, it was growing even as late as, it still continues to grow double digit. So why would you say, oh, you know what, we have a good idea, which is let's get into a very low margin business as the next big idea. Usually that's not considered good business decision making. But yet, you sometimes have to make that when you know that the margin structure that you may have fallen in love with is not long-term sustainable. The good news of that story is we caught it. We caught our own mistakes. In fact, Steve was the one who saw it, and he got me into this role. He asked me to go aggressively, gave me the support, and now it's the fastest-growing business, and quite frankly, we're doing super well in the cloud.
You write in the book that there's sort of a distinction between dystopian view of where we're going to go and a utopian view, and actually we're going to be somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. How is it that the public can trust that technology firms like yourselves, like Google, like Facebook, like Amazon, are going to give the public what they need and are not going to give the public simply what makes you money?
I mean, one of the things I think a lot about is with any new technology, we as a society have to be clear-eyed on both sides of it, which is the opportunities for this new technology to have profound impact in our daily life and do good, and at the same time be very mindful of unintended consequences. And in fact, you know, you say when the telegraph first came about, there was wire fraud. So in other words, we've seen this before, where even though technology brings a lot of good, you also have to be ready to deal, in fact, using technology, the unintended consequences. And I think that's going to be true even in the case of AI. Where at least I am focused on is all of the practical things that one can do as creators of AI. For example, I believe it's actually a design choice. Before we even get into the long-term morality, because I do believe a lot in path dependence, right? The fact that where you get started and how you get started has real consequences, on where you end up. What if we said, we're going to create AI that empowers humans as a core conscious design decision? I'll give you an example of it. And at Microsoft, one of the things that is really great to see, in fact, inspired by some of the projects we've done in the UK and some of the researchers in the UK and our engineers here, we built an app called Seeing AI, which is available actually on the Apple App Store. It uses our cloud computer vision technology to give anyone with visual impairment the ability to see. Another colleague of mine, Angela Mills, whom I recently ran into, was recounting this. She has some visual impairment as to what it's done for her, where she now can walk into our cafeterias, order food with confidence because this app allows us to see. She can walk into conference rooms knowing that that's the right conference room without barging into something that she's not been invited to, and make, in a sense, participating Microsoft fully. So I believe we've got to grab onto those opportunities. Now, having said that, we do have to think through, will we ever get to a stage in AI development where we have some of these runaway optimizations, which are all focused on essentially some optimization formula that doesn't care about humans? And that's where these, Asimov wrote about how to solve for the control problem. We do need the moral equivalent of that. And I think we have dealt with these, even in tech. How do we fight spam? Or how do we fight botnets? How does the industry come together to set standards for what are...
who sets those standards? This is the key point, I think. It's who sets those standards, and how do you ensure that the public and governments are involved in that debate? I know that a lot of technology companies are thinking very deeply about this. But, and I've asked this question of Mark Zuckerberg, and I've asked this question of Sundar Pichai, you can't be the only ones in this debate, because then you are setting the parameters that some people may have the suspicion are set for the good of you, not for the good of society. Whatever you talk about how great you are and how good you're going to be for human beings, what's your duty to involve the rest of the public square in this debate?
No, for sure. So the way I look at it is, first, what we need to do, which we have done, as I said, in lots of other areas, even in tech, around setting standards. You do this in gaming. In fact, there's a partnership of AI where all of us participate. And one of the state-of-the-art issues that we have with AI, especially with these deep neural nets, is how do they make decisions, right? One of the...
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and on-stage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Design principles I write about, beyond empowerment being one, is we need to take accountability for the AI we create. We can't abdicate, saying, look, this is a self-learning algorithm, we don't know what it's doing. That's just not possible. I think the society is not going to accept that. So that means we need to make AI that's more intelligible, so that then we can inspect it and then understand it. That, I think, is still an unsolved problem. But there are people pushing on the research of it. Let us share that, first of all, in public domain.
Just before I come to the audience, a couple of final questions. Let's talk about inequality. That's one of the big issues that technology is facing. And I don't mean particularly how technology companies can increase productivity, can maybe tackle some of the economic growth problems we have in the country, because I feel I would know what your answer to that is. What I'm actually more interested in is the complaint that actually technology companies themselves have created huge inequalities by the fact you work in such profitable ways, and that money that you have made has been reinvested in the company itself and to your investors. It must make you uncomfortable that Silicon Valley workers going to work on their buses are being egged by local residents who say, you jacked up all the house prices and I can't live here anymore. I mean, that must be a challenge for you. It's almost a challenge of your approach to show that you are creating value for people, because at the moment they may be looking at you and thinking, well, you're just creating value for yourselves.
Look, here's at least where I think it's important to distinguish even all of us as separate entities and with different business models. In our case, it's existential for us for there to be success outside of our balance sheet and income statement. It's simple, because there is no such thing. We're not some middleman in some two-sided market. Our entire thing is very straightforward. If there is value in what we create, you pay us. You will only pay us if you yourself are making money, whether it's a student, whether it's a public sector organization, whether it's a large multinational. Our entire business model is empowering people and organizations and their ability to create more technology. In fact, if anything, that's what gives me the greatest confidence in our business model, being able to create more surplus outside of us, because it's in our interest. It's not, I'm not saying this, that we're doing this out of altruism, but our business model itself is virtuous in the sense, and take the UK, for example. In fact, I was just studying this. Which started in an apprenticeship program in collaboration with the partner channel. And something like 10,000 apprenticeships were created even in the last couple of years, and we plan to grow that to 30,000. And I was thinking, wow, how is that happening? It's happening because these partners are growing their own businesses in technology around our platform, serving customers who are using digital technology to make their own surplus and creating employment. I believe that's what creates long-term business. And these inequities in societies, I think, are a challenge. Because if all that happens is one sector of the economy is doing super well, and then the rest of the economy, there is no wage growth or there is no job growth, I think is not a stable equilibrium.
For you to work in, no. I mean, Yuval Noah Harari's been on this stage. I've interviewed him, wrote Homo Deus about the future of technology. One big point he makes in that book is the digital divide, this notion that those people who can afford the digital accoutrements that increase their intelligence, their reach, their ability to use AI in the most powerful way possible will become almost these superhuman beings and will leave almost a sort of lumpen proletariat behind, who simply cannot afford to engage. And there's a similar argument made by Niall Ferguson in his new book, The Square, The Tower and the Square, which is that the networked people at the top will create value for themselves and will go on and will leave this group behind. I mean, how is you, as the head of one of the biggest global businesses here, tackle and think about that?
It's a great issue of our times, I think. I actually come at it the other way around. I look at it and say, how do we democratize these networks? How do we democratize these digital platforms so that, in fact, they're creating more inclusion? I mean, I'd give you a great example. You know, in the country I was born in. When I go back to India now and I see some of the startups and their need for capital to go after whatever it is that they're going after has now come down by a huge amount because they can just use our cloud. In fact, one of the most fascinating things is we all talk about AI. In fact, I look at it and say, the rate at which AI is being commoditized is faster than any other technology I've seen. In fact, most of the AI research, take computer vision, anything, is all being done in the public domain. They're all in research papers that are everywhere. And people like us have now just made that available as commodity services in the cloud for others to use. So to some degree, I feel that we can, in some sense, create more of an equal playing field. Even on the network side, LinkedIn, to me, what's our goal with LinkedIn? Our goal with LinkedIn at the highest of levels is to take whatever, the 3.3 billion people in the workforce and digitize those jobs, the skills, the training, so that it's available as a blueprint as it evolves, not as a static thing, but as it evolves for people to know what jobs to aspire to, what skills to acquire, and where to get that learning. Because I think that's going to be very, very key for economic growth, and especially getting your own economic return.
Now, I couldn't go to the audience before I ask you final question. Can you just explain Donald Trump to us?
You know, I've met the President of the United States twice, once before he was inaugurated and once after, along with a lot of my industry colleagues. a discussion on immigration. I went through essentially what I talked about. You know, I'm a product and a recipient of benefits of the American immigration system, why I believe it's to our competitive advantage to make sure that we are smart about how we do that, and also show humanity, because one of the other things with DACA in particular in the U.S., I feel that the American ethos is captured in not only making sure that the best and the brightest come to the country and skilled immigration, but it's also the being the beacon of hope for those who need it the most. And I think we should preserve it. And we are clear, I'm clear, and the president obviously listened to that. And the other piece I would also say is we talked about investment in digital technology and infrastructure, which is much needed. It's no different, quite frankly, than the conversation we had with the previous administrations or with any heads of state, whether here or in Germany. And so that's all I have to say.
Very delicately handled. Let's ask some questions. There's a man right at the back who's urgently put his hand up there. We'll have, that's a number two there. There's a gentleman there. We'll have number two first. And then there's a very fast man up there, number four. Yeah, number four, great, in the white shirt. Hello.
Hi, thank you very much for a very interesting conversation. My question is regarding artificial intelligence, and you mentioned how fast it's being commoditized. And my question is, how do you think, how scared we should be as humans of artificial intelligence replacing our everyday jobs, especially considering the fact that a lot of humans derive their self-identity from the jobs that we do every day? Thank you.
It's a great set of questions. So here's how I would think about this. One is, clearly, as there's more automation because of AI, there's going to be very hard displacement. Now, I think what do we need to do in order to prepare for that is first, actually, let's grab on to every job opportunity there is where we can race with the machine. There's a lot been written about that. Sometimes we sort of go all the way to full automation where the job is gone, except it's not. Like, in fact, I'll give you another example of our interesting collaboration in radiology between Cambridge and University of Washington and Microsoft, where they're using artificial intelligence to go through all of the images in preparation for radiotherapy. Because one of the more tedious process while you're preparing is to go through and make sure that you're just going to get the tumor, but not the other rest of the organs. And that process sometimes can be error prone and also takes a lot. So let's empower the radiologists with the latest assistive AI technology so that they can, one, get their job done faster and spend more time with the patient. Sometimes we go all the way, let's say, oh, the radiologists are going to be displaced, and it's not going to happen in that sequence. Having said that, let's take it to a next step. If there is full automation in any job, let us not fall victim to this thinking that there is a lump of labor. The economists call it the lump of labor fallacy. And the question is, are all the jobs that are going to be there in the future that have already been created? Obviously not. And that's where something like this LinkedIn economic graph can even act as a real-time feedback signal. So instead of trying to speculate about what the future is, let us, again, shape our skills and our economy with the real-time signal. For example, I'm a big believer that people-on-people jobs are going to be huge in our economies. They need to be supported through policy with wages. And so as things, let's say the capital is getting a huge return because of automation, but labor is required somewhere else, we will need to come up with mechanisms of the return on capital and return on labor with the right equation. So I think there are many things we can do in terms of how to, in a clear-eyed sense, look at AI, its progress, the market signal and policy so that we can be prepared versus thinking it's going to be dystopian as a binary state transition.
Number four at the back.
Thank you very much for an absolutely fascinating talk. Could I please get linked to the first question, your comment on online education? I think particularly over the next considerable number of decades, the new jobs that are coming into existence are going to demand a very specific skill set. And the old model where you would go to university, get a Bachelor of Arts in any subject, that's completely obsolete. It's obsolete now. You know, the tuition fees are far too high. The actual what you actually learn is not demanded anymore. Do you see online education, things like Harvard X Online, where you could learn Excel, you can learn accounting, you put on a resume, and then you could provide to an employer for a fraction of the cost? And do you see online education affecting secondary and primary education as well, not just in tertiary level?
I mean, in all honesty, I'm not the deepest of experts to speculate on that trajectory. I observe it in primarily through what we are trying to get done in LinkedIn, because we're trying to address that very challenge, which is the requirement of skills, or the mapping of skills to jobs, is very dynamic and it's changing. And therefore, it's super important for us to really have learning that relates to those skills required for the jobs. That's what we describe as the economic graph. And so that's why we're pouring a lot into the learning aspect. LinkedIn got started, obviously, more by trying to just map the jobs and the skills, but we recognize that learning is, I think, going to be super important, especially people aspire for returns on their labor and their economic opportunity. Now, having said that, what's the best mechanism? I think we should tackle some of the challenges you brought out, which is the high cost of education, more head-on, before we say the educational system is itself irrelevant. Maybe if we said, let's figure out a way for it to be more accessible. And then also recognize that just going to college and graduating is good enough to be ensuring yourself of all of your future economic opportunity, I think is just not going to be true anymore. I think you have to go reskill. So these apprenticeship programs, in-job training programs, for example, at Microsoft, when I look at all of what we are trying to do, even for engineers, when something, a new technology like AI comes in, we are doing AI schools. You have to, in some sense, hit the books again in a massive way, but in an applied sense. And so those are, I think, what is the responsibility of individuals. But they need assistance of tools and networks. Definitely LinkedIn is one of them. But also businesses and business leaders who are willing to invest in the training of their people. So I think that's at least what I would say is what needs to happen. And we see, I mean, the MOOCs definitely have a role to play. You know, I sign up for more MOOCs than I finish. But it's the fact that you can access them is just fantastic.
Down here, number one. Yeah.
Due to just how many companies are seizing the opportunity of the digital revolution, would you say that the next Microsoft or Apple is a realistic possibility in the near future?
You know, every time anyone has sort of said the success that anyone has had can't be surpassed, all you had to do is wait a little and they have been surpassed. So I do believe that innovation will come, companies will get built, success will happen. But it may not happen even narrowly like we think of it today as what is high tech. One of the most fascinating things that I'm observing as part of what I see around the world is every company I work with, whether it's Rolls-Royce or whether it is BMW or anyone, they're digital companies today. In other words, they have to, in fact, build their own software capability to produce these smart things, the smart cities, the smart financial products. So I don't think it's going to be the case that there's going to be a high-tech industry or a digital industry and then the rest. I think we're all, like electricity, I think we're all going to have the ability to use this new essential factor of production in very innovative ways. And if anything, one of the things I write about in the book is the need of the hour, both in terms of entrepreneurial energy and return, quite frankly, is that some of the harder challenges, like climate change, or any of the other, you know, food production even, are being solved by entrepreneurs who get the backing of risk capital, and then obviously the returns, so that there's more investment in sectors of the economy that go very beyond even a narrow, let's say, consumer-led internet.
Yep, number three.
I'd like to return to the cricket theme, if possible. Do you think that the drift to 2020 cricket away from Test cricket is symptomatic of a generational shift to instant gratification, maybe at the expense of depth and substance?
You know, let me say I wholeheartedly agree with you. I'm going to go to the Lords tomorrow, which is the very first time I've ever stepped in there. I admire and I love watching Test cricket. Unfortunately, I don't have the time for it. But luckily enough, because of at least streaming media, you can watch it in small chunks all over. But to me, that's the only form of cricket that I enjoy.
You talk in your book about this need for this big thought process around AI. But picking up on the gentleman's point, no one's going to bother about that. They'll want whatever it is as quickly as possible. And you will need to give it to them. You're not going to be able to sit around there, you know, Socrates-like, you know, thinking about, well, where are things going? Because your competitors are going to be out there moving fast and moving fast and breaking things.
It's a great
point.
Hasn't
that always been technology's way?
It's a great point. But here, let me just sort of argue a couple of things, which is... this is, I guess, somebody was saying there's a debate between the 1984 and the Brave New World, and that's a fantastic debate to be had, because in some sense, what's probably as much of a challenge is the Brave New World, and that is our own ability to amuse ourselves to death is a challenge if it's not checked. I'll give you where I get my inspiration for this. Minecraft. When I watch the Minecraft generation, they are not just playing a game. They are taking what is their imagination and bringing it to life. In fact, one of the interesting data points is if you introduce Minecraft in education, it equalizes even on the gender side the approach to STEM. In fact, it brings more girls because they're not, again, bound to some particular curriculum of computer science that may even have a bias. So I think the more creation tools we put in place, people will choose for even this instant gratification by doing things that are much more digital but artisanal.
Yeah, number one.
A question about you. What, if anything, did you learn from your Marxist father?
I would say the one thing that I did learn was, I mean, think about what an audacious guy Marx was in having the intellectual ambition to essentially put a formula to history. And my father definitely had that. He was a person who, he is a person who loves ideas and pushes new ideas. And he instilled that love for ideas in me. But if I think about even some of the issues we talked about around equity or the rise of inequity, we do need in our social democracies or our capitalist societies deal with some of the dystopian views that Marx had of late-stage capitalism. I think rereading that is not a bad idea because I think capitalism, only stable ground we have is if there is increasing levels of equity for more people. You know, one of the things about America that also is stunning to me is I believe, and there may be bigger experts here, never in human history have more people being able to live in an egalitarian society like the United States, which I think is one of those other precious things. You know, people talk about the blue-collar aristocracy. Angus Deacon even has, you know, written about it. It's stunning. I mean, you know, how many people who are blue-collar workers would have made something like $50,000, $60,000, which is what a lot of what was the wage support that they got in the U.S. To me, those are magical things that have happened in capitalism, and we have to somehow figure out how that can be broad spread. So at least, you know, I'm definitely a capitalist. I run Microsoft. But my father's Marxist leanings at least get me to think about what are the virtues of capitalism that we need to make sure we preserve and not, you know, be blinded by.
There aren't that many books by chief executives that quote Terry Eagleton, who is a famous Marxist cultural commentator, but it's in his book. Number one, yeah, this gentleman. Yeah, that's great. The gentleman here and then the lady in the blue top there, yeah, great.
What's your next project, big killer project? For example, you had Office and Windows. What's your next big killer project?
Well, you're among friends here, Satya, so you can tell us your next big launch.
You know, the thing that we're very excited about are developments in three areas. Obviously, I'm not going to talk about my product launch.
But you're all about sharing, Satya. That's this right. Is the new... Come on, we can test it.
There are limits to everything. Like, here's the thing. I'm very, very excited about mixed reality. I think we briefly touched on it. But this notion that what is your field of view is a computing experience is, I think, a real departure. It's the ultimate computing experience in some sense. We call it mixed reality because we think of virtual reality where you're fully immersed and augmented reality is just a dial setting versus two different platforms. So we're building devices, we're building cloud services for it. We're well on our way on that piece, but a lot to come. We talked plenty about AI and what it can do. You know, one of the projects that I'm most excited about is Cortana, in particular, as a digital assistant. I send mails and I'll say, I'll follow up with you tomorrow. It wakes up tomorrow and tells me, have you done that? And it helps me, you know, saves my day all the time. You know, one of the other magical things that has happened for us is language translation. You can be doing a PowerPoint presentation and simultaneously translate it into 60-plus languages, and people can follow along. I mean, the language barrier and all of the things that happen in communications. But the thing that we talked about even earlier this week for the first time more publicly, it's a little ways out there, is our quantum work. You know, for all this talk of great progress we've made, the first supercomputers had something like 13,000 transistors. The Xbox One X that's going to come out in October is going to have 7 billion transistors. So obviously we have a lot of capacity. Yet, let's talk about all the computational problems that are not solved. We can't even model an enzyme in natural food production. We don't have that catalyst that can absorb the carbon in the air. We can't design the new material that'll be superconducting in high temperature for lossless power transmission. These are all computational problems. And if you try to solve it using a classical computer, it'll take as much time as there has been between Big Bang to now. So we need a new approach. And interestingly enough, quantum mechanics does give us at least a theory. And we are well on our way to bring the math, the physics, and the computer science, because all the computer science, at least I learned, is just redundant for a quantum computer. And so we've got to put a complete new system together. So these are all ambitious projects that we are excited about, and we'll keep talking about it in the years to come.
Great. Okay. Yeah. Question here, number one, and then the lady at the back, just at the back of this block. Thanks. Yeah.
Hi there, thank you. It's been really inspirational and encouraging to hear some of the things you've been talking about, particularly as a fellow CEO working in a different sector. So I lead a company in financial services trying to rebuild trust in the financial sector, but really through working out how we can work with technology and education to bring financial security to the masses. And I think there are so many parallels I draw from the things you've talked about, but I don't see technology companies like yourselves embracing this challenge, working with us in financial services to try and bring this kind of change around these kinds of inequalities, around basic financial education and security. So I'd love your thoughts on that.
I mean, I think the first thing that you talked about is an issue that, in fact, I write a bit about, which is trust, and how are we as a technology company going to earn the trust of users of digital technology? And that's a very multi-constituent piece. And that's where I think we have to do some of the best work ourselves as technology providers. But also we need a policy framework that allows us to do that. But to your very specific question, this is the place where, at least in our context at Microsoft, our entire business model and our entire focus is how can we take digital technology and apply it in healthcare, in financial services, in any other sector of the economy, so that they can drive the dividends to all of their constituents, right? That, to me, I mean, when I think about the cloud and what it can mean, it's an ingredient in for you to be able to reduce your transactional costs. I mean, I look at even all of the blockchain applications that are being written, it's all fundamentally so that the transactional costs can come down and there can be more trust, and then whatever surplus gets created gets actually split and you know across all the constituents. So my job, at least as I think of it, is to really bring that force of commoditization to industry after industry. And we would definitely love to partner up, and we are, in fact, even right here in the UK, whether it's in financial services or others. And we do that not only through technology, but we have a massive, social responsibility and philanthropy piece to it as well, and working with the governments in partnership. So it will be something we should follow up.
Yeah, and one last question here, then that'll be it. Yeah, one last question. Yeah, very quick one.
Thank you for your talk. So how do you think about China and what's happening there? Because obviously the focus has been the Silicon Valley, but a lot of work is going on in China for in terms of technology and development. And do you have any thoughts? Is it a threat? It's an opportunity? And how do you deal with China?
That's a great question. You know, one of the things we talked a lot about is mostly Silicon Valley companies and so on. But you know, you're clearly what the Chinese companies are doing in technology, and in fact, I would say across industries is pretty phenomenal. And I think the dialogue between the United States, the United Kingdom, the rest of the European Union, and China is all going to be important. We can't think of this as let's the Western countries talk and figure this out, and China is going to be something that we'll deal with later. If anything, even take AI development. Whatever I just said about the control problem around AI, people from China have to be full participants in that dialogue. And that'll at least be what I will advocate every opportunity I get, and that's what my hope would be that we achieve.
Satya, thank you so much. Time is sadly against us. 90 minutes of fascinating thoughts from you. Thank you to you, the audience, for some fantastic questions. Thank you to Intelligence Squared. But in the main, thank you to Satya. His book is on sale in the foyer. I recommend you go and buy it.